A special interview with Dr. Mickey Eisenberg on the brand new American Heart Association initiative, the Global Resuscitation Alliance. Then in this week's second segment, we have a special sneak peek at our coverage of last week's EMS World Expo in New Orleans. If that's what you're looking for, you found it right here on this week's episode of the Medic Cast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medic Cast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's always fantastic to have you all join me here each week. First up in this week's episode, we have a special segment with Dr. Mickey Eisenberg from Seattle, Washington and King County, Washington EMS. He's on the show to talk about a brand new American Heart Association initiative called the Global Resuscitation Alliance. Then we'll have our first segment from EMS World Expo recorded last week in the Physio Control podcast studio in the exhibit hall there. That and more coming up later on in this episode. Before we get to all that though, it's always important to make sure you are checking back on the information we talk about in the show each week. And you can do that by heading over to the MedicCast blog at medicast.com/blog. There's a show notes link at the top of the page. Click that link and it'll take you right to the most recent episode. And of course, you can scroll down there and find previous episodes as well. There's also a search box there for you on the right-hand side. If you're looking for something in particular, you should be able to find it there. But take time. Make sure you follow up on what I talk about in the show each week and understand how it applies to your own EMS practice and protocols. If you want to get back in touch with me, you can always do that. Just shoot me an email. You can email me directly at podmedic@mac.com. So shoot me an email with your comments, your questions on an episode, maybe a suggestion you have or an interview idea for a future episode. Either way, I will get back to you. I work hard and respond back to all those emails that come in, and I'll get back to you as well. So please keep them coming. That's it for our contact information. I also want to make sure we give a quick thank you to Physio Control, whose generous support helped us cover the EMS World Expo conference in New Orleans last week. I hope you'll be looking forward as well as we bring you all the segments we recorded there in the podcast studio in the coming weeks here on the MedicCast. That's it for announcements. Let's go ahead and get on into the rest of the show. That is coming up in just a sec. Coming up next is a special segment from the American Heart Association where I interview Dr. Mickey Eisenberg about the brand new Global Resuscitation Alliance initiative. Check it out. Dr. Mickey Eisenberg, it's great to have you here on the MedicCast. It's been quite a while since we've had you on, and I'm really excited about having you here this week. I know a lot of the audience members probably know a little bit about who you are, but for those that don't, would you like to share with me and them a little bit about your background and what you're doing right now?
Sure. I've been involved with emergency medical services and resuscitation for well over four decades. Started back here in Seattle in 1971 when the Medic One program began with the Seattle Fire Department. And it's been a great adventure all those years, seeing how things have changed and gotten better. It's been an amazing ride.
Well, we're here today to talk about the a partnership that I have with the American Heart Association to talk about recent announcements of the Global Resuscitation Alliance, which is really exciting. And I know you wrote the paper that, or co-wrote the paper that directly led to the formation of the alliance. Could you tell us what led you to write that paper?
Well, there were several things. First of all, there exists tremendous disparity in cardiac arrest survival, probably between high-performing communities and underperforming communities. The disparity is probably on the order of tenfold. And that really seems to me something that ought to be improved. It ought to be changed. So the underlying assumption was that communities that adhered to best practices in terms of delivering emergency medical services for cardiac arrest ought to be able to double their survival in several years. And that's what the global resuscitation is all about. It's a partnership of people from over the world working with the American Heart Association to try to spread the information about programs that can transform an agency and about how to implement these programs. And it clearly states in the global resuscitation document that the goal is to double survival in all communities that embrace these changes and programs.
So that goal's pretty bold, although I think it's achievable. But what are some of the things that you think make it achievable? And you said adhering to best practices, but aren't a lot of people already doing that, or am I mistaken?
Well, yes and no. Certainly some communities are. But let me give an example. One of the best practices is telephone CPR, an opportunity to make every cardiac arrest call one in which the bystander begins CPR before the fire department arrives. We know from ample studies that bystander CPR, whether delivered by a trained person or by the telecommunicator, will double or even triple the likelihood of survival. So why isn't every dispatch center in the nation doing this? Well, a lot of reasons, but the biggest reason is that most dispatch centers claim that they are doing it. They have protocols in place, and there they can show on page X of their protocol book that they have a policy for telephone CPR, but the reality is that they're not delivering that message very often. And there's a lot of reasons, but the biggest reason is they're not doing quality improvement. They're not listening to the calls in which cardiac arrests occur and asking themselves, how can we do better the next time? So to have a protocol in place without ongoing quality improvement is just an empty program. So if you apply that reasoning to many aspects of resuscitation care, you can see that there's a tremendous gap between how programs think they're operating and how they're actually performing in the field.
I had the privilege of attending one of the Maryland Resuscitation Academies that were brought back here to the East Coast by Dr. Kevin Seaman, and really saw how that changed the way that people in this state looked at cardiac arrest survival. And I wonder what your thoughts are about applying some of the things that go on in the Resuscitation Academy to the various and varied systems of care around the world.
Well, that you mentioned Howard County and the state of Maryland, and they have done tremendous in terms of applying best practices and dramatically improving survival. Kevin Seaman has done an outstanding job. And that's exactly how we'd like it to play out in all of the states in this country and in other countries. So to give you an example, the Resuscitation Academy started in 2008. And in the last 8 years, we've trained over 1,000 people from about 30 different states, including virtually every county in Washington state. And these individuals who learn the best practices and are fired up to make them happen in their own community have really been transforming many of these agencies. They have indeed doubled survival. So we know the model works, and it's a matter of getting the key decision makers to be motivated to either come to an academy or read the books and try to learn what needs to be done. Whatever it takes, it's that kind of like that first step, which says we can do better. And once that step occurs, boy, there's no stopping some of these agencies. Now, to talk about the global alliance, so there was an international meeting held about 2 years ago, and the principals of the Resuscitation Academy were presented on a global platform. And again, it was embraced by representatives from Europe, Asia, Australia, and we now in effect have a four-continent global resuscitation alliance, which attempts to educate EMS programs about the programs and about the steps of implementation And we are, needless to say, very excited. And I know the Heart Association is going to do everything they can to spread the word. So it's there's no stopping us from trying to get the message out there.
I know in King County and Seattle region there, you all have achieved, I think, a 62% now survival rate for witnessed bystander cardiac arrest and in presence of ventricular fibrillation. That's just astounding and makes a lot of us wonder why we can't do as well. What are some of the things? Is it just something in the water there, or is there more we can do on an individual basis?
Well, it must be the Starbucks coffee, something like that. But we've always argued that there is no magic pixie dust. There is no secret sauce. It's just a lot of hard work. But there is no question, if you look at the range of EMS programs, and if you just look at VF, of course, the rhythm that has the most likelihood of resuscitation, you get this incredible spread of average performing communities are about 30% survival. Underperforming communities are 10% or even less. And communities that really adhere to best practices and have ongoing quality improvement, they're in the 50% or higher. So you've really got an opportunity that if you just take the median of all programs in the country at about 30%, you've really got an opportunity to really strike for that 50% higher range. And we're convinced it's possible. Again, there's no magic here. There's no rocket science or nuclear physics involved. It's very straightforward programs and adherence to quality improvement.
One of the things that are mentioned in the goals for the Global Resuscitation Alliance are to create a culture of leadership. You talked a little bit about that before, but for the people in my audience, for those individual EMS providers, the nurses, the other healthcare professionals that are checking out this program, what kind of advice would you give for them as an individual in their system to maybe, what can they do to become a champion for this?
Well, internal champions can really happen at any level. It can happen at the top with the chief or the administrative head of the agency or the medical director saying we can do better. And then a lot of things will flow from that decision. But it can also flow from the rank and file, the guys and gals who are delivering the service. Once they know that they can do better, they can really ask their leadership to be accountable. One way we think to get that kind of leadership in place is to kind of buy into the principle of accountability. Every EMS program should be accountable to the community it serves. So the question is, how are they accountable? Do they share information about their performance? Do they talk about plans to improve their performance? The more transparency there is in terms of an agency or program sharing with either the politicians, elected officials, the public at large, how are we doing and what are we planning to do even better? I think that's really the key to this leadership happening.
Well, Mickey, I want to thank you for sharing about this. We'll have links to this alliance and our resources online. And again, hopefully it's not so long the next time we talk, but thank you for really pushing this initiative to a global level.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks so much, Jamie.
Next up in the MedicCast is a look at the first segment I bring you from the Physiocontrol podcast studio at EMS World Expo in New Orleans last week. So check out this with some of the latest in EMS here for you on the MedicCast. Hi, Jamie Davis here from the MedicCast, and we've got Chris Montero from the EMS Garage as well. We're kicking off things here in the Physiocontrol podcast studio at EMS World Expo 2016 in New Orleans. And, you know, we are fired up. And, Chris, it's a lot going on. We've got a hurricane because we're in New Orleans, so there's got to be a hurricane somewhere.
Yep. I think every time they've come here, so we know in three more years when they're back here, there's going to be a big one. Wherever it's at, it's going to be big and it's going to happen. So Hurricane Matthew's getting ready to pummel the eastern United States, but that's okay. But this year is exciting. I think as I look around the floor and I look around what's been going on with some of our colleagues around the United States, it's been pretty interesting. And we have Rob Lawrence here, and I had Todd Stout out in Colorado recently, and you guys have been doing a lot of cool things with First Watch, but I think we should let you introduce yourself, and we'll go from there.
Well, I'm Rob Lawrence. I'm the British judge in this reality show, as always. Every reality show
You're
needs a British
Simon
judge.
Simon Cowell, great.
The Simon Cowell, yeah, get off. And I'm also the chief operating officer of the Richmond Ambulance Authority in Richmond, Virginia.
Very nice.
And you guys, actually, we haven't talked, Rob, because we just missed each other previous shows, but you, congratulations belatedly on winning last year's Paid EMS Service Award.
It's quite the honor, and I was really delighted to see New Hanover take the award away this year. And I was listening to a previous broadcast you did before, and it's winning doesn't mean you stop. It's actually now you've reached the plateau and you've got to keep going along it in order to keep innovating, to keep improving, to keep making the difference at EMS, which that actually gives you the platform to do.
What do you think was one of your biggest things that kind of pushed you over that edge where you felt like we're ready to kind of reach that pinnacle and continue moving forward?
It's the fact that everything is important. We're a 911 organization, we're a non-emergency patient transport organization. We like to innovate, we like to use the old gray matter. We're also a public health organization. Right. It's not just about the response, it's about the prevention as well. We're also part of a trauma system, and a trauma system is EMS, is public health, and is the hospital. And so therefore we become part of all of these sort of these circles that actually are interlinked, and by doing that it means that we can be the best that we can be, and of course then we can then pay everything forward, which is what we're a not-for-profit 501c3 organization. We believe in actually educating and enlightening the industry as we go.
Aren't you a PUM though as well?
We are a former PUM.
We are
a self-operated PUM, to be technically correct. So we don't have a contractor.
Right.
We're a one-system organization.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So what do you guys use? And I started with this segment with First Watch.
Yep.
You guys have been using First Watch for 19 years, 18 years?
We are the original First Watch customer,
right,
and we just celebrated an anniversary with them. And so we allow them to allow us to work smarter, because it's taking all of our information in, it's analyzing it, it's giving us back in alerts and in chunks of information that we require. Hot topic right now, we're using them to identify our frequent naloxone flyers. Everybody had frequent flyers in the past. We're now starting to see people that are having their naloxone with us more than once. So, I mean, it's a really hot topic. We're using that information, that intelligence, more importantly, to work within our own opioid workforces, task forces, in order to help make that difference. So that's helping us do that.
And just so people know, what is First Watch? Because for people listening, they may not be aware of it. Those of us that have been around in leadership positions may be more aware than others.
Let's put it in simple terms. If you had one person on a telephone and one telephone only, and that person worked 24 hours a day, that one person would have a real sense of situational awareness of what's going on in your system. Well, of course, we don't do that. And so you need something that's going to take all of your information and analyze it from both a biosurveillance perspective to work out whether you have incidents from a public health perspective, clusters of activity, whether it's a mass shooting, or whether biosurveillance looking at flu-like activity. You can actually program the system in to tell you when you are seeing similar incidences in the same geographical cluster, for example. So all of that information can then be passed back to us in order to act on. So we don't have to, we're taking the noise from the sort of squelch and the scatter, if you like, and then acting on what we're getting back. So that enables us to be very, very focused in our operation.
But it does more than that. I mean, it even in their new iteration where you can, where it does the first pass, where if the crew didn't sign their report, send that back. The data information and the informatics that go, you can analyze everything in your organization that has a data entry system and create reports around that and create a dashboard.
Let's talk about the second part. So we talked about First Watch there.
Right.
First Pass is our QAQI tool.
Right.
Now, if you go to a traditional organization, you're going to do your QAQI on maybe 100% of your cardiac arrests. You're going to have a thematic month where we're going to look at how the FTOs did, or we're going to look at how the last class of new entry orientation folk went to. With the system now, you can set up what they call bundles of care. So you can actually, because when you are completing an electronic patient care record, you are checking various boxes, drop-down menus, and saying that you've done stuff, it's time stamping, etc. Well, by doing that, we can then set up quality checks and audit checks against 100% of your record. And so we're able to analyze our records 100% of the time, all the time. Whereas before, I could tell you how fast I drove, the sort of Ricky Bobby rule of getting to the response and making the time, could do that. And of course, that's very important. It's a quality measure in itself when you think about triple aim and patient satisfaction. But now I can look at my clinical record and look at how well we are doing against the individual and against the organisation in terms of clinical quality, clinical treatment. And so therefore we're measuring response and also clinical treatment every day on the day.
And they can also pull outcomes from hospitals and integrate that back into the system so that your crew can go, oh, I want to see an outcome from that patient. And have you guys started down that road?
We're not doing that, but we're blessed. We have fantastic feedback from our hospitals anyway. Nice. And so we're from trauma, from STEMI, from, you know, taking in cardiac arrest patients, etc. The feedback is very, very quickly. And that's very important as well for the medic to know how well they did. So, you know, there is that sort of notion that once we get to the emergency department door, then, of course, we hand over, we scrub down, wash down, decontaminate, get back on the street. And of course, what we can now do is ensure they get the feedback. It's good for their professional development, and of course it's good for their morale as well to see that they're doing a really good job.
Nice. I think, you know, it's about a year ago or so we talked about data as being the big thing, I think, coming in EMS. And what I hear you saying is that you have a better handle on data today than you ever have. Well, do you see other services grabbing a hold of data in different ways the way they should, maybe?
I think it's coming on nicely. I mean, we talked before, we've sat here, you know, five years ago in the halls of any conference, you wouldn't see the amount of information handling organizations, the amount of information processing organizations that you do right now in the hall here today. So it's coming on in importance because, of course, again, we've talked about the fact that we need to do more research. In order to do more research, we need that information in manageable chunks in order to assess it, to analyze it, to, you know, to publish it and to act on it. And so that's very important to us, certainly at Richmond, but also I think it's now, you know, catching on in the industry. Programs like Compass, programs like, you know, everyone's got state data they're submitting. You know, don't just be an organization that feeds the beast. Actually take that information out and use it.
And I think I respect that because it's what drives you to be a better organization all the time. And you, as a fellow CEO of an organization, you're like, I don't know the answer, and I know the data's in my system, but I don't know how to get it out. Sometimes the data system can do that, sometimes it can't, but that just that ability to go in and manipulate that data without having a barrel of IT guys behind me just to write reports is so important as a manager.
Well, certainly for EMS leaders, having the information is a good thing, but you need the good people to be able to analyze it, because what the product is, it's an intelligence product. Okay, we are going out and collecting the information, we're putting it into a database, we're then deciding what the key question is, what the question of the day is, what the hypothesis is, and then we're getting that information out. And then, of course, it does take the Mark I eyeball and the Mark I brain to interpret that information in order to, you know, generate action. And so the military call it the intelligence cycle, and it's exactly what we're doing. We're taking, gaining, assessing, collating, collecting, and then acting on it. And it's a constant cycle of activity.
Well, and there's been a lot of business intelligence has grown up in other organizations. We're just getting there. And I think, and quite honestly, I think we're probably a little even ahead of traditional hospitals in doing something with business intelligence. I think they're getting there, but insurers have been doing it a long time. And other places in normal commerce, like GE and other places like that, that actually use business intelligence. Mm-hmm. We just haven't done that yet, but I think we're seeing more organizations do that today, even small organizations.
Well, case in point is the current opioid epidemic. We have the information. We know the who, the why, the where, the when. You know, we can produce, you know, maps that show us not so much the point of sale, but point of consumption. Sometimes they're almost in the same spot.
Right.
We understand the age range. In Richmond, for example, and it's a real shocker, the average age of our folk that we are reviving with the naloxone isn't a teenager, isn't a 20-something. It's, and the average age is 34 years old.
Wow.
And then, of course, there is correlation with the research that's gone on, that there are folk that have been on prescription medication, and then they've come off that and they've had to find some other sort of source and fix for that. And so we're seeing a much older population coming through. So it's not like other sort of drugs where it's, you know, sort of the in rave thing to have. We're seeing a much older, I hate to use the word discerning, but they are a population that know what they need, and they're going out to get it. And of course there is a retail organization, Alfresco, set up to make sure they do.
And they have And they maybe in some cases they have more resources to purchase because they are in the stage of life where they might be better off at least temporarily. Until
it catches up with them. And it spans the cross-section of society. You can't sort of put the finger on one particular demographic, one age range, one socioeconomic group. It's everywhere, and we need to work very, very hard. We have the information to assist with that and the intelligence.
So Rob, with all your systems and everything, I know we're going to talk about opioids on my show today and the issue with heroin and things like that, but what is the next big thing in EMS? What's our... we've done community paramedicine, we've done integrated health. What's the next thing? What are we at in our growth cycle? Where are we going to be in another 5 years?
Well, it's interesting. If you go to places like Eagles, they're now looking at the evidence to say, is ALS about to become a dinosaur? Because if we start to look at, the creation of a national trauma system that's being based on the military experiences in places like Afghanistan, it's the ability of that basic life support function to be able to save a life. Now, that's possibly heresy to some organizations that are in here exhibiting and meeting today, but, perhaps it's a fact. And so that's one thing that, we need to work out. Are we becoming overqualified? There's another sort of discussion going on around, does everybody need a degree in paramedicine? And we're going to talk about that in a session this afternoon, in fact, tomorrow, looking at international models of EMS. You have the UK and Australia that are going to a Bachelor of Science level degree program. The problem they're having, though, is those folk, once they get that, are then bypassing the ambulance and going straight into primary and secondary care, where their skills are being employed, and of course they're making more money. So it's an issue that, are we going to overtrain people? So that's another... What's coming up? Probably controversy on many, many levels when we have to, get through that as we head towards 2020. In November, all bets could be off. We have an election coming up, and so we could be sitting here this time next year and go, well, that Affordable Care Act, wasn't that fun while it lasted? I don't know, but all bets could be off in a few weeks' time.
That's a great point. I don't know that the Affordable Care Act will ever go away. I think it may change over time, and that's fine, but I think that we're also seeing, too, in Colorado, we've had some state exchanges close, the amount of money that they're trying to charge customers is just outrageous. So will they exist like they are today in 5 years? Probably not. But how do we then, as EMS professionals, partner with those agencies to bill appropriately? We're looking at next year, we're looking at a Medicare reduction, we're looking at all these other things that are going to impact our bottom line as an industry.
It's another, maybe controversy of the industry that we are doing MIH, we're doing CP. We're talking about the wonderful and massive savings we're making for the system and define the system later. But we still have to pay the bills, we still have to put staff on duty in order to do the job, and the savings that we're making aren't necessarily coming our way, so we need a fix in order to do that. And again, we're coming up to an election, so we're going to have to start lobbying hard come December, January, or come January onwards, in order to start to influence those that we can influence to assist us in doing our job, which is actually, and again, back in the UK, my job wasn't admission avoidance, it was arrival avoidance. We're not supposed to take the patient to the hospital anyway if there is a pathway elsewhere, and that's the basis, of course, of MIH CP now, but there is the wherewithal and the funding, albeit diminishing in the National Health Service, but the money is there to assist those programs to exist, because we know that if we throw everybody into hospital, that's going to drive costs up. It's not very satisfactory, and that's something we need to work on.
So what are you doing for patient satisfaction now? Do you guys have a tool, or how do you implement patient satisfaction?
Well, first of all, patient satisfaction, if we're thinking about the triple aim, and that's a huge marker that's required in the future, because we're going to be talking about value, not volume. We're going to have to find ways of demonstrating how well we're doing in order to make the very limited healthcare dollar that's about to be out there. And so, again, actually, let's bring it right back to the show. There are a number of organizations that are here that are going to assist you, if you haven't already got a program, getting into doing your own patient satisfaction scores and programs in order to demonstrate that value when we cast aside volume. We too are working towards those aims and agendas in order to make sure that we can demonstrate the volume that we're doing.
But how do we...
Or the value, sorry.
And I think this is the struggle I always have with patient satisfaction in our industry. And don't get me wrong, I love it. I think we should be doing it, but what do we measure? What am I measuring that is going to be common in the industry? I think we should have a patient satisfaction summit. and we should all come together and say, you know, maybe a little bit like HCAPS or something like that, where we're all coming together saying, these are the things that, so I can know how I'm doing compared to you, and I can also know how I'm doing compared to me.
Well, you know, Joint Commission, HCAPS and all that, and right, we need to learn to speak hospital language.
Right.
That's a very good point, because they are all about the measurement, the satisfaction, the risk management, etc. And so, yeah, well, that's something that we need to do, because they're already doing this and they're already having to live that environment. So we need to speak hospital. I mean, that's maybe a takeaway going forward. So, you know, in terms of satisfaction, but what does the patient care about, first of all? And my boss, Chip Decker, and he's in the hall somewhere right now, when he does the opening sort of day of the new entry orientation, new employee orientation, he says something that's very profound, is that, you know, okay, who can tell me what the patient complains about? Is it the fact that you used the wrong size cannula? You know, oh dear, the bore of that needle was a bit too large for my liking, I normally have something smaller. Or was it that the patient was mean to me? Or the medic was having a bad day?
Right.
And so the complaint is never of a clinical nature by the large. It's actually about the attitude and the approach of the medic delivering the service. And so, you know, the satisfaction is, are we nice? You know, we try and recruit nice people. You know, you've got the EMS qualification. We can actually take you through our perception process and prepare you for our streets. But you have to have that base character first in order to do the job. You know, we're a caring organization. You know, now, of course, we're getting busier and busier and busier, and sometimes maybe trying to care becomes a little bit more challenging. But you know, we are there for that patient, no matter what their 911 call purpose is, whether it's emergency, whether it's, you know, whether it's psych, whether it's emotional, whether it's, you know, something social. But we're there. We are, you know, the last health and social care safety net, and that's what I said about the National Health Service in the UK too. So we have to turn up on a smile on what's probably somebody's worst day, you know, this year, this week, their life, whatever.
Right.
And so people really get concerned when you turn up and you're grumpy. It's a fact.
Well, it's true. And I've always said that. I said, people don't know when they're killing you, but they know when you're being mean.
Exactly.
It's just like a tenet of our business.
Right. And it's no difference to EMS across the world.
Right.
No difference
exactly
at all.
Well, and I think that, you know, we've seen, and maybe we could take some cues from some of our hospital colleagues, because there are, don't get me wrong, there are some grumpy ER nurses, mainly there at night, but we won't tell them that. But the night crew is a little different anyway. But I think that it's a culture that starts at the top too. It's, hey, this is the culture that we have here,
right,
and this is our expectation of how you're going to treat people.
Yep.
I mean, whether they're the 10th time that you've gone there to give them Narcan, or whether it's the 10th time that you've gone there to take them to wherever, you have to still continue to show compassion. Because or you'll miss something. You're also going to miss something. It'll be that one time that you're like, oh, I'm going back to Mrs. Jones, and you know, she only wants this.
Right.
But you're going to miss something if you're not compassionate.
Attitude starts, you're right, it starts at the top. Everything from being nice to the patient to the overall culture of safety, which has to be led.
Ooh, that's good.
You know, it has to be led. And you have to start by saying, you know, we're going to work you hard here because it's the nature of the business, but we want you to go home in one piece. And here are the practices, techniques, and procedures and processes that we've put in place to keep you safe, whether it's from staging on a call that's involving, you know, something that might be violent, through to, you know, how to safely lift a patient off the floor, how to safely, you know, when to call for the bariatric stretcher that's not hydraulic versus a stretcher that can lift 700 pounds but it's not called bariatric. These sort of things you need to understand, that you know, how to be safe, how to use the, say, lifting stuff. Again, we're back in the hall here. Again, a lot of stuff around safety here too. You can go and find, you know, pneumatic air cushions. We can go and find, you know, stretchers that will load themselves, pretty much, stretchers that are powered, etc. It's about looking after the provider. And of course, it's about not injuring the provider as well, because most medics of a certain age can remember the day their back went, you know, and we don't want to have that anymore.
Right. So we've been talking about a lot of stuff, and we're going to be talking about a lot more the rest of the conference, but we have to wrap this up.
Sure.
Rob, where can folks find you if they want to follow you online? I know you're very active on Twitter. I know your service is very active on social media.
So RAA is at RAA EMS. That's very easy. And being from England, I'm at UK Rob L. That's as simple as that.
Excellent.
Nice.
Yes.
And Chris?
People can find me at Geeky Medic on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, whatever. But you can also find my service at EC Paramedics on Facebook.
And again, congratulations officially here on the show your reaching the point of CEO of that organization. I know they're very lucky to have you.
Thank you. I didn't have gray hair before I started.
Well, it'll be even grayer next year, right?
Probably next year, yes.
And I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. You can find me under the handle PodMedic in most places. And of course, follow me over at MedicCast.com. And we want to look for you to reach back out to us. If you heard something you liked, you want more information or want to get a question answered, reach out to us either at the places we mentioned or you can reach out to me directly and we want to hear from you. So that's it. We're here at EMS World Expo 2016 in New Orleans in the Physio Control Podcast Studio. We want you to make sure you follow all of our coverage here, and you can do that by going over to MedicCast.com and see all the coverage there. And we will have more segments to come, so stay tuned.
That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week and, of course, remind you to follow up on all of the information you get in this week's show over at the MedicCast blog. That's at MedicCast.com/blog. Over there, you'll find a show notes link at the top of the page. Go ahead and take a moment and follow up on all of the information and links to news items and more you find there each week. You can also sign up for our email newsletter that'll bring you those links directly into your email inbox each week if you want. There's a form on the right-hand side of the page. Just go ahead and fill that out, and you can get the MedicCast newsletter for yourself. I also welcome your comments and suggestions by email. So if you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com. Send in your ideas for news links, ideas for future show topics or interviews, whatever comments you might have. I really do look forward to hearing from you, and I'll make sure I get back to you. I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, so please keep those emails coming. If you want to catch up with me on social media and some of the pages and sites out there, you can find me at most places under the handle PodMedic. So you can catch me over at Twitter at twitter.com/PodMedic or Facebook at facebook.com/PodMedic. Friend or follow me over there. Also, don't forget to check out our MedicCast Facebook page. We now have over 5,000 followers, so head over to facebook.com/MedicCast. Click the like button on the top of the page and join the community over there. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. Please make sure you spread the word and share the MedicCast with your colleagues and students and friends in the EMS world. I'll be back here each week with new episodes, new interviews, news items, tips, and more every Monday morning to start off your EMS week. Tell somebody else about the MedicCast today. I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. It's time to close out the show. Don't forget to thank our sponsors. And remember, folks, Scene Safety, BSI.